toward Wally's office. Why does she have to stop by every afternoon? You used to see clients after 5, Oscar jumped in. Now you're just locked in there with her. She's not bothering anyone, Wally said, and not so loud. She bothers me, Rochelle said. Wally raised both palms, arched his eyebrows, and was instantly ready for a brawl. Look, she and I are getting serious, and it's none of your business. Got that? I'm not going to discuss it further. There was a pause as everyone took a breath, then Oscar launched another round. I suppose you've told her about Crayox and the big settlements is just around the corner, so it's not surprising she's hanging around, right? I don't talk about your women, Oscar, Wally fired back. Women? More than one? Rochelle's eyes widened, and David remembered all the good reasons for hating firm meetings. Oscar glared at Wally in disbelief for several seconds. Both men appeared stunned at their exchange. Let's move along, David said. I'd like permission to study our fee structure and attempt to come up with a proposed schedule that will aim for uniformity. Any objections? There were none. On a roll, David quickly passed around some sheets of paper. This is a case I've stumbled across, and it has great potential. Nasty teeth, Oscar said, looking at a color photo of the collection. Yep. The client is a 5-year-old boy in a coma from lead poisoning. His father purchased this set of teeth and fangs last Halloween, and the kid kept them in his mouth for hours. The various paint colors are loaded with lead. Page 3 is a preliminary report from a lab in Akron where one Dr. Biff Sandroni examined the teeth. His conclusion is at the bottom. All 6 sets of plastic teeth are coated with lead. Dr. Sandroni is an expert on lead poisoning, and he says this is one of the worst products he's come across in the last 25 years. He thinks the teeth were probably made in China and imported by one of the many low-end toy companies here in the States. Chinese factories have a terrible history of coating 1 million different products with lead paint. The Food and Drug Administration and the Bureau of Consumer Protection scream and order recalls, but it's impossible to monitor everything. Rochelle, looking at the same handout as Oscar and Wally, said, That poor child. Is he going to make it? The doctors think not. There's substantial damage to his brain, nervous system, and many of his organs. If he lives, he'll be a very sad sight. Who's the manufacturer? Wally asked. That's the big question. I've been unable to find another set of nasty teeth in Chicago, and Helen and I have been poking around for a month. Nothing online, nothing in suppliers' catalogs. So far, no clue. It's possible that the product shows up at Halloween only. The family did not keep the package. There must be similar products, Wally said. I mean, if the company makes crap like this, then surely it makes crap like fake mustaches and such. That's my theory. I'm accumulating a nice collection of similar items, and I'm researching the importers and manufacturers. Who paid for this report? Oscar asked suspiciously. I did. $2,500. This caused a gap in the conversation as all 4 looked at the report. Finally, Oscar asked, Have the parents signed a contract with our firm? No, they've signed a contract with me so I could get the medical records and begin the investigation. They'll sign one with the firm if I ask them to. The question is simply this, does Finley and Fig take this case? If the answer is yes, then we need to spend some money. How much? Oscar asked. The next step is to hire Sandroni's outfit to go into the apartment where the boy and his family live and look for lead. It could be in other toys, paint on the walls that's chipping, even in the drinking water. I've been to the apartment, and it's at least 50 years old. Sandroni needs to isolate the source of the lead. He's fairly confident we have the source, but he wants to exclude everything else. And how much does that cost? Oscar asked. $20,000. Oscar's jaw dropped, and he shook his head. Wally whistled and scattered the sheets of paper. Only Rochelle was hanging on, and she really didn't have a vote when the issue was spending money. With no defendant, there's no lawsuit, Oscar said. Why burn cash investigating this when you don't know who to sue? I'll find the manufacturer, David said. Great. And when you do, then we have ourselves a lawsuit. Maybe. The door to Wally's office rattled, then opened. Deanna took a step out and said, Wally, how much longer, baby? Just a few minutes, Wally said. We're almost finished here. But I'm tired of waiting. Okay, I'll be there in a minute. She slammed the door and the walls shook. I guess she's now running the firm meeting, Rochelle observed. Knock it off, Wally said to Rochelle. Then to David, he continued. I like this case, David, I really do. But with the Crayox litigation in full swing, we can't commit to spending big money on another case. I say, you put this on hold, maybe keep looking for the importer, and after we settle Crayox, we'll be in a great position to pick and choose. You've got this family signed up. This kid ain't going anywhere. Let's keep it on a leash and crank it up next year. David was in no position to argue. Both partners had said no. Rochelle would say yes if she had a vote, but she was losing interest. Fair enough, David said. Then I would like to pursue it myself, in my spare time, with my own money, and under the protection of my own malpractice policy. You have your own policy? Oscar asked. No, but I'll get one easy enough. What about the 20 grand? Wally asked. According to the financials here, you've grossed less than $5,000 in the last 4 months. True, but each month has exceeded the prior one. Plus, I have a little cash in the bank. I'm willing to roll the dice and try to help this little boy. It's not about helping a little boy, Oscar shot back. It's about financing the lawsuit. I agree with Wally. Why not put it off for a year? Because I don't want to, David replied. This family needs help now. Wally shrugged and said, Then go for it. I have no objections. Fine with me, Oscar said. But I want to see an increase in your monthly gross. You'll see one. Wally's door opened again, and Deanna stormed out. She stomped across the room, hissed the word, Bastard! Under her breath, then yanked open the front door, snarled, Don't call me! In the general direction of the table, and shook the walls again when she slammed the door behind her. She has a temper, Wally observed. What a class act, Rochelle said softly. You can't be getting serious with her, Wally, Oscar said, almost pleading. She falls under the category of my business and not yours, Wally said. Anything left on the agenda? I'm tired of this meeting. Nothing else from me, David said. Meeting adjourned, the senior partner announced. Chapter 23. The great Jerry Alessandros finally made his appearance on the Chicago stage of his grand war against Varick, and his arrival was impressive. First, he landed in the Gulfstream G650 that Wally was still dreaming of. Second, he brought with him an entourage that rivaled the one that surrounded Nadine Karras when she went to court. With Zell and Potter front and center, the playing field seemed level. Third, he had the skill, experience, and national reputation one would never find at Finley and Fig. Oscar skipped the hearing because he wasn't needed. Wally couldn't wait to get there so he could strut in with his stud co-counsel. David tagged along out of curiosity. Nadine Karras, her team, and her client had selected Iris Klopek as their guinea pig, though neither her attorneys nor Iris herself had the slightest whiff of the master scheme. Varick had filed a motion to separate the plaintiff's cases, to make 8 different lawsuits out of one, and to keep the litigation in Chicago, instead of having it lumped with thousands of other cases in the brand-new multi-district litigation in southern Florida. The plaintiff's lawyers opposed these motions strenuously. Thick briefs had been swapped. The mood was tense when the squads of lawyers gathered in Judge Seawright's courtroom. As they waited, a clerk came forth and announced that the judge was delayed by some urgent matter but should be out in half an hour. David was loitering near the plaintiff's table, chattering with a Zell and Potter associate, when a defense lawyer slid over for a contrived hello. David vaguely recognized him from somewhere in the halls of Rogan Rothberg, but he had tried hard to forget those people. I'm Taylor Barclay, the guy said on top of a quick handshake. Harvard, 2 years ahead of you. A pleasure, David said, then introduced Barclay to the Zell and Potter lawyer he had just met. For a few minutes, they chatted about the Cubs and the weather and finally got around to the issue at hand. Barclay claimed to be working around the clock as Rogan was getting slammed with Crayox work. David had lived that life and survived it, and he had no desire to hear it again. Should be a hell of a trial, David said to fill in a gap. Barclay snorted as if he had the inside scoop. What trial? He said. These cases will never get near a jury. You know that, don't you? He asked, looking at the Zell and Potter associate. Barclay continued, half under his breath because the place was crawling with wired lawyers. We'll defend like hell for a while, pad the file, rack up some obscene fees, then advise our dear client to settle. You'll figure out this game, Zink, if you stay in it long enough. I'm catching on, David said, watching every word. He and the Zell and Potter associate were both on their heels, absorbing but not believing. For what it's worth, Barclay said in a whisper, You're almost a legend around Rogan these days. A guy with the balls to walk away, go find an easier job, now sitting on a pile of cases that are a gold mine? We're still slaving away by the hour. David just nodded, hoping he would go away. The courtroom deputy suddenly came to life and ordered everyone to stand. Judge Seawright swept in from behind the bench and ordered everyone to sit. "Good morning," he said into his mic as he arranged his papers. "We have a lot of ground to cover in the next 2 hours, and as always, brevity with words will be appreciated. I am monitoring discovery, and it appears as though things are proceeding on course. Mr. Alessandros, do you have any complaints about discovery?" Jerry stood proudly because everyone was watching. He had long gray hair swept back over his ears and bunched around his neck. His skin was well tanned, and his custom-tailored suit hung perfectly on his lean frame. "No, sir, Your Honor, not at this time, and I am delighted to be in your courtroom. Welcome to Chicago. Miss Karras, do you have any complaints with discovery?" She stood in her light gray silk and linen dress, V-neck, empire waist, tight down the slender legs, long below the knee, with black platform pumps, and all eyes feasted upon her. David was looking forward to the trial just to watch the fashion show. Wally was drooling. "Your Honor, we exchanged lists of experts this morning, so everything is in order," she said, her voice rich, her diction perfect. "Very well," Seawright said. "That leads to the biggest issue of the day, that of where these cases will be tried. The plaintiffs have filed a motion to move all the cases to join the multi-district litigation in federal court in Miami. The defendant objects and not only prefers to keep the cases here in Chicago, but also to separate them, try them one at a time, beginning with the estate of one Percy Klopek, now deceased. These issues have been thoroughly and exhaustively briefed. I've read every word. At this point, I'll allow remarks by both sides, beginning with the attorneys for the plaintiffs." Jerry Alessandros walked with his notes to a small podium in the center of the courtroom, directly in front of and several feet below Judge Seawright. He carefully arranged his papers, cleared his throat, and began with the typical, "If it pleases the court." For Wally, it was the most exciting moment in his career. To think he, a hustler from the Southwest Side, was sitting in federal court watching great lawyers do battle over cases he had found and filed, cases he was responsible for, cases he had created, it was almost too much to behold. As he suppressed a grin, he felt even better when he touched his midsection and slid a finger under his belt. Down 15 pounds, sober for 195 days. The lost weight and clear head were no doubt linked to the indescribable fun he and Deanna were having in bed. He was eating Viagra, driving a new convertible Jaguar, new to him but slightly used and financed over 60 months, and feeling 20 years younger. As he buzzed around Chicago with the top down, he dreamed endlessly of his Crayox money and the glorious life ahead. He and Deanna would travel and lie on beaches, and he would work only when necessary. He had already decided that he would specialize in mass torts, forget the humdrum of the street, the cheap divorces and drunk drivers, and go for the big money. He was certain he and Oscar would split. Frankly, after 20 years, it was time. Though he loved him like a brother, Oscar had no ambition, no vision, no real desire to step up his game. He and Oscar had already had a conversation about how to hide their Crayox money so his wife would see little of it. Oscar would go through a bad divorce, and Wally would be there to support him, but when it was over, the partners would split. It was sad, but inevitable. Wally was going places. Oscar was too old to change. Jerry Alessandros got off to a bad start when he tried to argue that Judge Seawright had no choice but to transfer the cases to Miami. "These cases were filed in Chicago, not Miami," the judge reminded Alessandros. "No one made you file them here. I suppose you could have filed them anywhere you can find Varick Labs, which I presume is in any of the 50 states. I'm having trouble understanding why a federal judge in Florida thinks he can order a federal judge in Illinois to transfer his cases down there. Can you help me here, Mr. Alessandros?" Mr. Alessandros could not. He tried valiantly to suggest that nowadays in mass tort litigation it is customary to establish multi-district litigation and have only one judge preside over all the cases. Customary, but not mandatory. Seawright seemed irritated that someone, anyone, would suggest that he was required to move the cases. They were his. David sat behind Wally in a row of chairs in front of the bar. He was enthralled by the drama of the courtroom, the pressure, the high stakes, but he was also worried because it was apparent Judge Seawright was against them on this issue. However, Alessandros had assured their team that winning these initial motions was not crucial. If Varick Labs wanted to try a single test case in Chicago, and to do so quickly, then so be it. He had never run away from a trial in his career. Bring it on! The judge, though, seemed hostile. Why was David worried? There would be no trial, right? All the lawyers on his side of the aisle believed secretly, fervently, that Varick Labs would settle its Crayox mess long before the trial started. And if Barkley on the other side could be believed, the defense lawyers were also thinking settlement. Was it a rigged game? Was this how the mass tort business really worked? A bad drug gets discovered. The plaintiff's lawyers go into a frenzy rounding up the cases. Lawsuits are filed. The big defense firms respond with an endless supply of expensive legal talent. Both sides slug it out until the drug maker gets tired of writing fat checks to its lawyers. Then everything gets settled. The plaintiff's lawyers rake in huge fees, and their clients get far less than they expected. When the dust settles, the lawyers on both sides are richer. The company cleans up its balance sheet and develops a replacement drug. Was this nothing more than good theater? Just as Jerry Alessandros began to repeat himself, he sat down. The lawyers perked up as Nadine Karras stood and walked to the podium. She had a few notes, but didn't use them. Since it was obvious the judge agreed with her, she kept her arguments brief. She spoke in long, eloquent sentences, as if they had been written down with plenty of forethought. Her words were clear, her voice carried nicely around the courtroom. Nothing was wasted. No extra verbiage, no useless gestures. The woman was meant for the stage. From several angles, she made the point that there was no case, no rule of procedure, no precedent anywhere that required a federal judge to transfer one of his cases to another federal judge. After a few moments, David was wondering if he would actually get to watch Ms. Karras in action before a jury. Did she know at that very moment there would be no trial? Was she just going through the motions at $2,000 an hour? A month earlier, Varick Labs reported its quarterly earnings, which were down significantly. The company surprised analysts by writing off $5 billion for the projected costs of ongoing litigation, primarily Crayox. David was following this closely in financial publications and blogs. Opinion was split between those who thought Varick Labs would hurry and clean up its mess through a massive settlement, and those who thought the company might try to weather the storm through hardball litigation. The stock price ping-ponged between $35 and $40 per share, so the stockholder seemed reasonably calm. He was also studying the history of mass tort litigation and found it surprising the number of times that a defendant corporation's stock rose impressively when it settled and got rid of a bunch of lawsuits. There was normally a dip in the stock price with the first wave of bad news and hysterics from the plaintiff's bar, but as battle lines were formed and the numbers became firm, Wall Street seemed to prefer a good settlement. What Wall Street hated was squishy liability, the kind that was often seen when a big case was handed over to a jury and the results were unpredictable. In the past 10 years, virtually all of the major mass tort cases involving pharmaceuticals had been settled, and for billions. On one hand, David was finding comfort in the research, but on the other, it had turned up little in the way of credible proof that Crayox did all the terrible things it was accused of doing. After a thorough and fair debate, Judge Seawright had heard enough. He thanked the lawyers for the preparation and promised a ruling within 10 days. The extra time was not needed. He could have ruled immediately from the bench. There was little doubt he would keep the cases in Chicago, and he seemed to favor the idea of a show trial. The plaintiff's lawyers retired to the Chicago Chop House, where Mr. Alessandros had reserved the back room for a private lunch. Including Wally and David, there were 7 lawyers and 2 paralegals, all men, and they all took their places around an oblong table. Jerry had pre-ordered wine, and it was poured as soon as they sat down. Wally and David declined. "A toast," Jerry announced as he tapped his wine glass. Silence. "I propose a toast to the Right Honorable Harry Seawright and his famous rocket docket. The trap has been laid, and the fools at Rogan Rothberg think we're blind. They want a trial. Old Harry wants one too, so by God, Let's give him a trial. Everyone took a sip, and within seconds the conversation spiraled down to an analysis of the legs and backside of Nadine Karras. Wally, who had the right-hand seat to the throne of Mr. Alessandro's, offered comments that were deemed hilarious. Over salads, the chatter quite naturally made its way to their second favorite subject, settlement. David, who was saying as little as possible, was coaxed into telling the story of his encounter with Taylor Barkley just before the hearing. His narrative was received with great interest, too much, in his opinion. It was Jerry's stage, and he did most of the talking. In equal parts, he was enthusiastic about a big trial with a big verdict, but he was also supremely confident Varick would buckle and put billions on the table. Hours later, David was still confused, but he was also comforted by the presence of Jerry Alessandro's. The man had fought the wars, inside the courtroom and out, and he almost never lost. According to Lawyers Weekly, the 35 partners at Zell & Potter split $1.3 billion in net profits the previous year. Net, after new jets, a firm golf course, and every other lavish expense allowed by the IRS. According to Florida Business Magazine, Jerry's net worth was somewhere around $350 million. Not a bad way to practice law. David had not shown these numbers to Wally. Chapter 24. For almost 30 years, Kirk Maxwell represented Idaho in the U.S. Senate. He was generally well regarded as a steady hand who shunned publicity and preferred to work off camera to get things done. He was quiet, unassuming, and one of the more popular members of Congress. However, his sudden death was nothing short of spectacular. Maxwell had the Senate floor, microphone in hand, arguing fiercely with a colleague from the other side of the aisle, when he suddenly clutched his chest, dropped his mic, opened his mouth in horror, and crashed forward into the back of the desk in front of his. He died instantly of cardiac arrest, and it was all captured on the official Senate camera, released without proper authorization, and seen by the world on YouTube before his wife could get to the hospital. 2 days after his funeral, his wayward son mentioned to a reporter that the senator had been taking Crayox and the family was considering a lawsuit against Varick Labs. By the time this was digested through a 24/7 news cycle, there was little doubt that the drug had killed the senator. Maxwell was only 62, in fine health, but with a family history of high cholesterol. An angry colleague announced a subcommittee hearing into the hazards of Crayox. The Food and Drug Administration was besieged with demands that the drug be pulled. Varick Labs, hunkered down in the hills outside of Montville, offered no comment. It was another dark day for the company, but Reuben Massey had seen worse. Such a lawsuit would be ironic for two reasons. First, in his 30 years in Washington, Senator Maxwell had taken millions from Big Pharma, and, as far as the industry was concerned, had a perfect voting record. Second, the senator was an ardent tort reformer who had voted for years to place severe restrictions on the filing of lawsuits. But in the aftermath of a tragedy, irony is often lost on those left behind. His widow hired a noted plaintiff's lawyer in Boise, but for consultation only. With Crayox on the front page, Judge Seawright decided a trial might be interesting after all. He ruled against the plaintiffs on all issues. The lawsuit Wally had filed and then amended would be broken up into separate pieces, with the case of the late Percy Klopek being the first to get slotted into the fury of Local Rule 8319, the Rocket Docket. Wally was panic-stricken when he received notice of the ruling, but he began to settle down during a long and soothing conversation with Jerry Alessandro's. Jerry explained that the death of Senator Maxwell was a gift from heaven, in more ways than one because a rabid tort reformer had been silenced and would only increase the pressure on Varick to begin settlement talks. And besides, as Jerry kept saying, he would welcome the chance to be on center stage versus the lovely Ms. Karras in a packed Chicago courtroom. The last place they want to see me is in a courtroom, Jerry said again and again. His Klopek trial unit was hard at work at that very moment. His firm had dealt with many egocentric federal judges with their own special versions of their own little rocket dockets. Seawright didn't create the rocket docket, Wally asked innocently. Heavens no, Wally. I heard that term 30 years ago in upstate New York. Jerry went on to encourage Wally to continue combing the streets for more Crayox cases. I'm about to make you rich, Wally, he said again and again. 2 weeks after Senator Maxwell's death, the FDA caved and ordered Crayox off the market. The mass tort bar was orgasmic, and lawyers in a dozen cities issued statements to the press, most of the same variety. Varick will have to answer for its gross negligence. A federal investigation should be launched. The FDA should never have approved the drug. Varick knew it had problems but had rushed the drug to market, where, in 6 years, it had grossed over $30 billion for the company. Who knows what's really buried in the Varick research? Oscar was conflicted by the news. On one hand, he, obviously, wanted the drug to generate as much bad press as possible to force the company to come to the table. But on the other hand, he was secretly, fervently, hoping the drug would take care of his wife. Pulling it would ratchet up the pressure on Varick, but it would also remove the drug from her medicine cabinet. Actually, Oscar's perfect outcome would be breaking news of a pending settlement at about the same time his wife croaked on the drug. He could keep all the money, avoid a messy divorce, then file suit on behalf of his dear departed wife, and nail Varick yet again. He dreamed of such things behind his locked door. The phone lines were blinking nonstop, but he refused to pick up. Most of the calls were from Wally's non-death cases, folks Wally had tracked down through his various schemes. Let Rochelle, Wally, and young David worry about the calls and the frantic clients. Oscar planned to stay in his office and avoid the frenzy, if possible. Rochelle was ready to quit, and she demanded another firm meeting. "See what you've started?" Oscar sneered at David as all four gathered around the table late one afternoon. "What's on the agenda?" Wally asked, though everyone knew. Rochelle had twisted David's arm to the point where he was willing to run interference. He cleared his throat and got right to the point. "We have to get these Crayox cases organized. Since the drug was pulled, the phones are ringing like crazy with people who either are already signed up or want to jump on board." "Ain't it great?" Wally said with a wide, satisfied grin. "Maybe, Wally, but this is not a mass tort firm. We're not equipped to handle 400 cases at a time. Your big mass tort boys have dozens of associates and even more paralegals, lots of bodies to handle the work." "We have 400 cases?" Oscar asked, and it wasn't clear if he was pleased or overwhelmed. Wally slurped down some diet soda and said proudly, "We have the 8 death cases, of course, and 407 non-death cases and counting. And I'm sorry that these minor cases are causing so much trouble, but when it's time to settle, and when we get to plug these guys into the compensation grid hammered out by Jerry Alessandro's, we'll probably learn that each non-death is worth a paltry $100,000 or so, times 407. Anybody here want to do the math?" "That's not the issue, Wally," David countered. "We get the math. What you're missing is the fact that these cases may not be cases. Not a single one of these non-death clients has been evaluated by a doctor. We don't know if they've actually been harmed, do we?" "No, not yet, and we have not filed suit for these clients either, have we now?" "No. But these people certainly believe they're full-fledged clients and they're about to be compensated. You've painted a rosy picture." "When will they see a doctor?" Oscar asked. "Soon," Wally shot in his direction. "Jerry's in the process of hiring an expert doctor here. He will examine each patient and give a report."
"And you're assuming that everyone has a legitimate claim?" David asked.
"I'm not assuming anything."
"How much will each exam cost?" Oscar asked.
"We don't know until we find the doctor."
"Who's paying for the exams?" Oscar asked.
"The Crayox Litigation Group, KLG for short."
"Are we in the hook?"
"No."
"Are you sure?"
"What is this?" Wally growled angrily. "Why is everybody hammering me? The first firm meeting was all about my girlfriend. This one is all about my cases. I'm starting to dislike firm meetings. What's wrong with you guys?"
"I'm fed up with these people on the phone," Rochelle said. "It's nonstop. Everybody's got a story. Some are crying because you've scared them to death, Wally. Some even stop by and want me to hold their hands. They all think they got bad hearts because of you and the FDA.
What if they do have bad hearts, and their bad hearts are caused by Crayox, and we're able to get them some cash? Isn't that what lawyers are supposed to do?"
"What if we hire a paralegal for a few months?" David suggested, rather abruptly, then braced for the reactions. When the other three didn't speak quickly enough, he plowed on. "We can stick him or her in the junk room upstairs and send all the Crayox cases up there. I'll help him or her set up the litigation software and filing system so that he or she is on top of every case. I'll supervise the project if you want. All phone calls dealing with Crayox can be routed to the new office.
We take the pressure off Rochelle, and Wally can keep doing what he does best, hustle cases.
We're not in a position to hire anyone, Oscar said predictably. Our cash flow is far below normal, thanks to Crayox. And, since you're not paying the bills yet, and not even close to doing so, I might add, I don't think you're in a position to suggest spending more money.
I understand, David said. I was just suggesting a way for the firm to get itself organized.
Actually, you're quite lucky we decided to hire you, Oscar thought to himself and almost said aloud.
Wally liked the idea, but at the moment didn't have the spine to take on his senior partner. Rochelle admired David for his boldness, but she wasn't about to comment on an issue dealing with the overhead.
I have a better idea, Oscar said to David. Why don't you become the Crayox paralegal? You're already upstairs. You know something about litigation software. You're always squawking about getting organized around here. You've been wanting a new filing system. Judging by your monthly grosses, it looks as though you have some spare time. It'll save us some dough. What do you say?
It was all true, and David wasn't about to back down.
Okay, what's my cut of the settlement?
Oscar and Wally looked at each other, all four eyes narrowing as this rattled around their brains. They had not yet decided how they themselves would split the money. There had been some loose chatter about a bonus for Rochelle and one for David, but as for the real division of the spoils, not a word.
We'll have to talk about that, Wally said.
Yes, this is a matter for the partners, Oscar added, as if being a partner in their firm were akin to belonging to an exclusive and powerful club.
Well, hurry up and decide something, Rochelle said. I can't answer all these calls and do all the filing.
There was a knock on the door. Deanna was back.
Chapter 25. Reuben Massey's master plan to deal with his company's latest drug mess had been upended by the death of Senator Kirk Maxwell, who was now derisively known in the Varick hallways as Jerk Maxwell. His widow had not filed suit, but her windbag of a lawyer was thoroughly savoring his 15 minutes in the spotlight. He was readily available for interviews, even got himself on a few of the cable yak fests. He colored his hair, bought some new suits, and was living the dream of so many lawyers. Varick's common stock had dipped to $29.50, its lowest price in 6 years. Two Wall Street analysts, two men loathed by Massey, had issued sell recommendations. One wrote, "After only 6 years on the market, Crayox accounts for one quarter of Varick's revenue. With it off the market, the company's near-term forecast is quite uncertain." The other wrote, "The numbers are frightening. With 1 million potential Crayox plaintiffs, Varick will be mired in the cesspool of mass tort litigation for the next 10 years. At least he got the word cesspool right, Massey mumbled to himself as he flipped through the morning financials. It was not yet 8 a.m. The sky over Montville was cloudy, the mood inside his bunker was somber, but oddly, he was in good spirits. At least once a week, and more often if possible, Mr. Massey allowed himself the pleasure of eating someone for breakfast. Today's meal would be especially delightful. As a young man, Leighton Cohn had served 4 terms in the U.S. House before he was called home by the voters after a messy affair with a female staffer. Disgraced, he was unable to find meaningful work back home in Tennessee, and as a college dropout, he possessed no real talents or skills. His resume was embarrassingly thin. Divorced, unemployed, bankrupt, and only 40 years old, he drifted back to the Capitol and decided to venture down the yellow brick road traveled by so many washed-up politicians. He embraced one of Washington's time-honored traditions. He became a lobbyist. Unburdened by ethical considerations, Cohn quickly became a rising star in the game of pork. He could find it, smell it, dig it out, and deliver it to clients willing to pay his constantly rising fees. He was one of the first lobbyists to understand the intricacies of earmarks, those addictive little dishes of lard so craved by members of Congress and paid for by unwitting factory workers back home. Cohn first got noticed in his new trade when he collected a $100,000 fee from a well-known public university in need of a new basketball arena. Uncle Sam pitched in $10 million for the project, an appropriation found in the fine print of a 3,000-page bill passed at midnight. When a rival school heard about it, a brouhaha ensued, but it was too late. The controversy put Cohn on the map, and other clients came running. One was a real estate developer in Virginia who envisioned the damming of a river, thus creating a lake, thus allowing lakefront lots to be sold at hefty prices. Cohn charged the developer $500,000 and instructed him to drop another $100,000 into the pack of the congressman who represented the district where the dam was not needed. Once everyone was paid and on board, Cohn went to work on the federal budget and found some spare change, $8 million, in a defense appropriation to the Army Corps of Engineers. The dam was built. The developer made a bundle. Everyone was happy, but the environmentalists, conservationists, and the communities downstream. This was business as usual in Washington and would have gone unnoticed but for a persistent reporter from Roanoke. Embarrassment and black eyes all around, the congressman, the developer, Cohn, but in the lobbying trade there is no shame and all publicity is good. Cohn's business soared. After 5 years in the game, he opened his own shop, the Cohn Group, specialists in governmental affairs. After 10 years, he was a multimillionaire. After 20, he was annually ranked as one of the three most powerful lobbyists in Washington. Does any other democracy rank its lobbyists? Varick paid the Cohn Group a flat retainer of $1 million per year, and much more when actual work was done. For that kind of money, Mr. Leighton Cohn would come running when his client said so. As witnesses to the bloodbath, Reuben Massey decided to use his most trusted lawyers, Nicholas Walker and Judy Beck. The three were in place when Cohn arrived, alone, as per Massey's instructions. Cohn now owned a jet, had a chauffeur, and liked to travel with an entourage, but not today. Things got off to a cordial start as they exchanged pleasantries and nibbled on croissants. Cohn had gained even more weight, and his tailored suit was pulling at the seams. It was shiny gray with a sheen similar to that usually seen on suits worn by television evangelists. His well-starched white shirt was bulging around the waist. His fleshy triple neck was straining under his collar. As always, he wore an orange tie and orange pocket square. Regardless of his wealth, he had never learned how to dress. Massey loathed Leighton Cohn and viewed him as a rube, a dope, a hack, a huckster who was lucky enough to be in the right place at the right time. But then Massey loathed almost everything about Washington, the federal government and its stifling regulations, the horde of staffers who wrote them, the politicians who approved them, the bureaucrats who enforced them. To survive in such a dysfunctional place, he figured, one had to be as greasy as Leighton Cohn. "We're getting hammered in Washington," Massey said, stating the obvious. "Not just Washington," Cohn replied with his twang. "I own 40,000 shares of your stock, remember?" True, Varick Labs had once paid the Cohn Group with stock options. Massey picked up some notes and peered over his reading glasses. "Last year, we paid your company over $3 million. $3 million, too, Cohn said. "And we contributed the maximum amount to either the re-election campaign or the PAC of 88 out of 100 members of the U.S. Senate, including, of course, the late great Maxwell, may he rest in peace. We maxed out to over 300 members of the House. In both houses, we maxed out to both parties' central slush funds, whatever the hell they're called. We maxed out to no fewer than 40 PACs, all supposedly doing God's work down there. In addition, 24 of our senior executives did their own version of maxing out, all under your guidance. And now, thanks to the wisdom of the Supreme Court, we are able to funnel into the electoral system vast sums of cash that cannot be detected. Over $5 million last year alone. If you tally all this up, and you include all payments of all types, reported and unreported, above the table and below, Varick Laboratories and its executives forked over almost $40 million last year to keep our great democracy on the right track. Massey dropped the papers and glared at Cohn. $40 million to buy one thing, Leighton, the one and only product you have to sell. Influence. Cohn was nodding slowly. So please tell us, Leighton, with all this influence that we've purchased over the years, how in hell does the FDA pull Crayox off the market? The FDA is the FDA, Cohn replied. It's a world of its own, immune from political pressure, or so we're led to believe. Political pressure? Everything was fine until a politician died. It looks to me like his buddies in the Senate pressured the hell out of the FDA. Of course they did. Then where were you? Don't you have former FDA commissioners on your payroll? We have one, but the important word is former. He no longer gets a vote.
So it appears to me as if you got out-politicked. Perhaps for now, Reuben. We've lost the first battle, but we can still win the war. Maxwell's gone, and he's being forgotten by the minute. That's what happens in Washington. They forget about you real fast. They're already campaigning in Idaho to replace him. Give it some time, and his death will be forgotten.
Time? We're losing $18 million a day in sales because of the FDA. Since you arrived here this morning and parked your car, we've lost $400,000 in sales. Don't talk to me about time, Layton.
Nicholas Walker and Judy Beck were, of course, taking notes, or at least scribbling something on their yellow legal pads. Neither looked up, but both were enjoying this little workout.
Are you blaming me, Reuben? Cohn asked, almost desperately.
Yes, absolutely. I don't understand how that rotten place works down there, so I hire and pay you a bloody fortune to guide my company through the minefield. So, yes, Layton, when something goes wrong, I blame you. A perfectly safe drug has been yanked off the market for no valid reason. Explain that to me, can you?
I can't explain it, but it's not fair to blame me. We've been on top of this matter since the first lawsuits were filed. We had solid contacts up and down the line, and the FDA showed little interest in pulling the drug, regardless of how loud the trial lawyers were screaming. We were safe, and then Maxwell collapsed in fine fashion on video. That changed everything.
There was a pause as all four reached for their coffee cups. Cohn never failed to bring along some gossip, some inside knowledge that was passed along in whispers, and he couldn't wait to share it. A source tells me the Maxwell family does not want to file a lawsuit. A very good source.
Who? Massey demanded.
Another member of the club, another senator who's very close to Maxwell and his family. He called me yesterday. We had a drink. Sherry Maxwell does not want a lawsuit, but her lawyer does. He's pretty shrewd, realizes he's got Varick in his crosshairs. If the lawsuit is filed, it's another round of bad news for the company. More pressure on the FDA to keep the drug off the market. But if the lawsuit goes away, then Maxwell will soon be forgotten. One headache down, more to follow. Massey flipped his right hand in circles. Keep going, spill it. For $5 million, the lawsuit will go away. I'll handle it through my office. It will be a confidential settlement, no details whatsoever.
$5 million for what? For a drug that did no harm?
No, $5 million to soothe a big headache, Cohn replied. He was a senator for almost 30 years, an honest one, so his estate is not too impressive. The family needs a little cash.
Any news of a settlement will trigger an avalanche with the tort boys, Nicholas Walker said. You can't keep this quiet. There are too many reporters watching.
I know how to manipulate the press, Nick. We shake hands on a deal now, sign the papers behind locked doors, and wait it out. The Maxwell family and their lawyer will have no comment, but I'll make sure there's a nice leak to the effect that the family has chosen not to file suit.
Look, there's no law, not even in this country, that they have to sue.
People walk away from lawsuits all the time for all sorts of reasons. We cut the deal, sign the papers, promise them the money in 2 years, plus interest. I can sell it.
Massey stood and stretched his back. He walked to a tall window and surveyed the fog and mist seeping through the woods. Without turning around, he said, "What do you think, Nick?"
Thinking out loud, Walker said, "Well, it would certainly be nice to get the Maxwell matter out of the way. Layton's right. His pals in the Senate will forget about him quickly, especially if there's no lawsuit on page 2. $5 million sounds like a bargain in the scheme of things."
"Judy?"
"Agreed," she said without hesitation. "The priority is getting the drug back on the market. If making the Maxwell family happy speeds this along, I say go for it."
Massey slowly returned to his seat, cracked his knuckles, rubbed his face, sipped his coffee, obviously a man in deep thought. But he was anything but indecisive. "Okay, Layton, do the deal. Get rid of Maxwell. But if this settlement blows up in our faces, I'm terminating our relationship immediately. Right now, I'm not happy with you and your firm, and I'm looking for a reason to shop around."
"No need to do that, Reuben. I'll make Maxwell go away."
"Super. Now, how long before Crayox is back on the market? How long and how much?"
Cohn gently rubbed his forehead and removed a few tiny beads of sweat.
"I can't answer that, Reuben. We need to go one step at a time and run out some clock. I'll shove Maxwell under the rug, then let's meet again."
"When? 30 days?
"Great. 30 days is $540 million in lost revenue."
"I got the math, Reuben.
I'm sure you do.
I got it, Reuben. Okay?
Massey's eyes were flashing, and his right index finger was jabbing through the air in the direction of his lobbyist.
Listen to me, Layton. If this drug is not back on the market in the very near future, I'm coming to Washington to fire you and your firm, and then I'll hire a whole new bunch of government affairs specialists to protect my company. I can get a meeting with the vice president and the speaker of the house. I can have drinks with a dozen or so senators. I'll take my checkbook and a truck full of cash, and if I have to, I'll take a carload of hookers to the FDA and turn them loose.
Cohn offered a fake smile as if he'd heard something funny.
No need for that, Reuben. Just give me a little time.
We don't have a little time. The quickest way to get Crayox back on the market is to prove it's not harmful, Cohn said coolly, wanting to divert the chatter away from being fired.
Any ideas?
We're working on it, Nicholas Walker said. Massey stood again and returned to his favorite window.
Meeting's over, Layton, he growled, and did not turn around to say goodbye.
As soon as Cohn was gone, Reuben relaxed and felt better about the morning. Nothing like a human sacrifice to get a hard-nosed CEO in good spirits. As Nick Walker and Judy Beck checked their emails on their smartphones, Reuben waited. When he had their attention, he said,
I suppose we should discuss our settlement strategy. What's the timeline now?
The Chicago trial is on track, Walker said. There is no trial date, but we should hear something soon. Nadine Karras is watching Judge Seawright's calendar, and there's a nice gap in late October. With some luck, it might happen then.
That's less than a year after the lawsuit was filed.
Yes, but we've done nothing to slow it down. Nadine's putting up a stiff defense, going through all the motions, but no real obstacles. No motion to dismiss, no plans for summary judgment. Discovery is proceeding nicely. Seawright seems to be curious about the case and wants a trial. Today is June 3rd. They're still filing lawsuits. If we start talking settlement now, can we string it out until October? Judy Beck responded,
No problem at all. Fetazine took 3 years to settle, and there were 500,000 claims. Zoldovan took even longer. The tort bar is thinking about one thing, the $5 billion we charged off last quarter. They're dreaming of that much money hitting the table.
It'll be another frenzy, Nick said.
Let's get it started, Massey said.
Chapter 26 Wally was sitting in divorce court on the 16th floor of the Richard J. Daley Center downtown. On tap for the morning was Straight v. Straight, one of a dozen or so miserable little divorces that would forever, hopefully, separate two people who had no business getting married in the first place. To untangle things, they had hired Wally, paid him $750 in full for an uncontested divorce, and after 6 months were now in court on opposite sides of the aisle, anxious for their case to be called. Wally waited, too. Waited and watched the procession of scarred and warring spouses trek meekly to the bench, bow at the judge, speak when their lawyers told them to, avoid eye contact with each other, and after a few somber minutes leave, unmarried again. Wally was in a group of lawyers, all waiting impatiently. He knew about half of them. The other half he'd never seen before. In a city with 20,000 lawyers, the faces were always changing. What a rat race. What a grinding treadmill. A wife was crying in front of the judge. She didn't want the divorce. Her husband did. Wally could not wait until these scenes were history. One day soon he would spend his time in a swanky office closer to downtown, far away from the sweat and stress of street law, behind a wide marble desk with two shapely secretaries answering his phones and fetching his files, and a paralegal or two doing his grunt work. No more divorces, DUIs, wills, cheap estates, no more clients who couldn't pay. He would pick and choose the injury cases he wanted and make big money in the process. The other lawyers were watching him warily. He knew this. They mentioned Crayox from time to time. Curious, envious, some hoping Wally would strike gold because that would give them hope. Others, though, were eager to see him fall flat because that would prove their drudgery was what they were meant to do. Nothing more. His cell phone vibrated in his coat pocket. He grabbed it, focused on the name and number of the caller, then jumped from his seat and sprinted from the courtroom. As soon as he cleared the doors, he said,
Jerry, I'm in court. What's up?
Big news, Brother Wally, Alessandro sang. I played 18 holes of golf yesterday with Nicholas Walker. Ring a bell?
No, yes, I'm not sure. Who?
We played on my course. I shot a 78. Poor Nick was 20 strokes back. Not much of a golfer, I'm afraid. He's the chief in-house lawyer for Varick Labs. Known him for years. Prince of an asshole, but honorable. There was a gap Wally needed to fill here, but he could think of nothing helpful. So, Jerry, you didn't call to brag about your golf game, right? No, Wally, I'm calling to inform you that Varick wants to open a dialogue on the issue of settlement. Not actual negotiations, mind you, but they want to start talking. This is the way it usually happens. They crack the door, we get a foot in, they tap dance, we tap dance, and before you know it, we're talking money. Big money. Are you with me, Wally? Oh, yes. I thought so. Look, Wally, we have a long way to go before your cases are in a posture to be settled. Let's get to work. I'll line up the doctors to do the exams. That's the crucial part. You need to jack up your efforts to find more cases. We'll probably settle the death cases first. How many do you have now? 8. Is that all? Thought it was more. It's 8, Jerry, with one on the fast track, remember? Klopek. Right. With that hot chick on the other side. Frankly, I'd like to try that one just to stare at her legs all day. Anyway, let's kick into high gear. I'll call later this afternoon with a game plan. Lots of work to do, Wally, but the fix is in.
Wally returned to the courtroom and resumed his wait. He kept repeating, the fix is in, the fix is in. Game's up, party's over. He'd heard it all his life, but what did it mean in the context of high-powered litigation? Was Varick throwing in the towel, surrendering so quickly, cutting its losses? Wally assumed so. He glanced at the haggard, beaten-down lawyers around him. Ham and Eggers, just like himself, who spent their days trying to squeeze fees out of working stiffs with no money to spare. You poor bastards, he thought. He couldn't wait to tell Deanna, but first he had to talk to Oscar, and not at Finley and Fig, where no conversation was ever private. They met for lunch 2 hours later at a spaghetti house not far from the office. Oscar had had a rough morning trying to referee 6 grown children fighting over their dead mother's estate, in which there was virtually nothing of value. He needed a drink and ordered a bottle of inexpensive wine. Wally, at 241 days sober, had no trouble sticking with water. Over caprese salads, Wally quickly recapped his conversation with Jerry Alessandros and ended with a dramatic, "This is the moment, Oscar. It's finally going to happen." Oscar's mood changed as he listened and gulped down the first glass. He managed to smile, and Wally could almost see the skepticism evaporating. He took out a pen, shoved the salad aside, and began scratching. "Let's run through the math again, Wally. Is a death case really worth $2 million? Wally glanced around to make sure no one was listening. The coast was clear. "I've done a ton of research, okay? I've looked at dozens of settlements and mass tort drug cases. There are too many unknowns right now to predict how much each case is worth. You gotta determine liability, cause of death, medical history, age of the deceased, income earning potential, stuff like that. Then we gotta find out how much Varick is tossing in the pot. But $1 million is the floor, I think. We have 8. Fees are at 40%, half to Jerry, plus a stroke for his expertise, and we're looking at a net to our firm of something like 1.5 mil. Oscar was scribbling with a fury, though he'd heard these numbers 100 times. "They're death cases. They gotta be worth more than 1 mil each," he said, as if he'd handled dozens of these large cases. "Maybe 2, Wally said. "Then we got all the non-death cases, 407 as of now. Let's say only half can qualify after a medical exam. Based on somewhat similar cases, the mass drug variety, I think $100,000 is a reasonable figure for a client whose heart valve has been slightly damaged. That's $20 million, Oscar. Our cut is something in the neighborhood of $3.5 million. Oscar wrote something, then stopped, took a long drink of wine, and said, "So, we should talk about our split, right? Is that where this is going?" "The split is one of several pressing issues. Okay, what's wrong with 50-50? All fee fights began with an even split. Wally stuffed his slice of tomato into his mouth and chewed it fiercely. "What's wrong with 50-50 is that I discovered Crayox, rounded up the cases, and so far, I've done about 90% of the work. I have the 8 death cases in my office. David has the other 400 upstairs. You, if I'm not mistaken, have no Crayox cases in your office. You're not asking for 90%, are you?"
"Of course not. Here's my suggestion. We have a ton of work to do. All these cases have to be screened by a doctor, evaluated, and so on. Let's put everything else aside, me, you, David, and get to work. We prep the cases while we're also looking for new ones.
Once the settlement news breaks, every lawyer in the country will go crazy over Crayox, so we got to get even busier. And once the checks arrive, I think a 60-30-10 split is fair.
Oscar had ordered the lasagna special, and Wally the stuffed ravioli. When the waiter was gone, Oscar said, "Your fee is twice mine? That's never happened before. I don't like it."
"What do you like?"
50-50.
"And what about David? We promised him a cut when he agreed to take the non-death cases."
"Okay, 50 for you, 40 for me, 10 for David. Rochelle gets a nice bonus, but no piece of the pie." With so much money on the way, it was easy to toss around the numbers, even easier to cut a deal. There had been nasty fights over $5,000 fees, but not today. The money soothed them and took away any desire to squabble. Wally slowly reached across, and Oscar did the same. They quickly shook hands and plunged into their entrees. After a few bites, Wally said, "How's the wife?" Oscar frowned, grimaced, and looked away. Paula Finley was a subject completely off limits because no one at the firm could stand her, including Oscar. Wally pressed on. "You know, Oscar, this is the moment. If you're ever going to ditch her, do it now."
"Marital advice from you?"
"Yes, because you know I'm right."
"I assume you've been thinking about this."
"Yes, because you have not, and that's because you never believed in these cases until now, perhaps."
Oscar poured more wine and said, "Let's hear it." Wally leaned in closer again as if they were swapping nuclear secrets.
"File for divorce now, immediately. No big deal. I've done it 4 times. Move out, get an apartment, cut all ties.
I'll handle it on your end, and she can hire whomever she wants.
We'll draw up a contract, dated 6 months ago, and it'll say that I get 80% of the Crayox settlements, if any, and you and David split 20%. You gotta show some income from Crayox, otherwise our lawyer will go nuts. But most of the money can stay in a slush fund for, I don't know, a year or so until the divorce is over. Then, at some unknown point in the future, you and I settle up.
That's a fraudulent transfer of assets."
"I know, I love it. I've done it 1,000 times, though on a much smaller scale.
I suspect you have, too. Pretty clever, don't you think?
If we get caught, we could both get thrown in jail for contempt of court with no hearing."
"We will not get caught. She thinks Crayox is all mine, right?"
"Right.
So it'll work. It's our law firm, and we make the rules on how the money gets split, completely within our discretion."
"Her lawyers won't be stupid, Wally. They'll know all about the big Crayox settlement as soon as it happens.
Come on, Oscar, it ain't like we hit these licks all the time. Over the last 10 years, I suspect your adjusted gross has averaged, what, $75,000?
Oscar shrugged. "About the same as yours. Pretty pathetic, don't you think? 30 years in the trenches."
"Not the point, Oscar. The point is that in a divorce, they'll look at what you've earned in the past."
"I know. If the Crayox money is mine, then we can argue with evidence that your income hasn't changed."
"What will you do with the money?"
"Bury it offshore until the divorce is over."
"Hell, Oscar, we could leave it offshore and pop down to Grand Cayman once a year to check on it.
Believe me, there's no way they'll ever know.
But you gotta file now and get out."
"Why are you so keen on me getting a divorce?"
"Because I loathe that woman. Because you've been dreaming of a divorce since your honeymoon.
Because you deserve to be happy. And if you sack this bitch and hide the money, your life will take a dramatic turn for the better.
Think of it, Oscar, single at 62 with cash in the bank."
Oscar couldn't suppress a smile. He drained his third glass. He took a few bites. He was obviously struggling with something, so he finally asked, "How do I break it to her?"
Wally dabbed the corners of his mouth, stiffened his spine, and assumed the voice of authority.
"Well, there are many ways to do it, and I've tried them all. Have you two ever talked about splitting up?"
"Not that I recall. I assume it would be easy to start a big fight."
"Oh, so easy. She's always unhappy about something, usually money, and we fight almost every day."
"That's what I figured. Do it like this, Oscar. Go home tonight and drop the bomb. Tell her you're unhappy and you want out. Plain and simple. No fighting, no bickering, no negotiating. Tell her she can have the house, the car, the furniture. She can have it all if she'll agree to a no fault.
And if she won't agree, leave anyway. Come stay at my place until we can find you an apartment. Once she sees you walk out the door, she'll get angry and start scheming, especially Paula. It won't take long for her to blow up. Give her 48 hours and she'll be a cobra."
"She's already a cobra." and she has been for decades. We'll file the papers, have them served on her, and that'll send her over the edge. She'll have a lawyer by the end of the week.
I've given this advice before. Just never thought I'd do it myself.
Oscar, sometimes it takes balls to walk away. Do it now while you can still enjoy life.
Oscar poured the last of the wine into his glass and started smiling again. Wally could not remember the last time he'd seen his senior partner so content.
Can you do it, Oscar?
Yep. In fact, I think I'll go home early, start packing, and get it over with.
Awesome. Let's celebrate with dinner tonight, on the firm.
A deal, but that bimbo won't be around, right?
I'll lose her.
Oscar downed the wine like a shot of tequila and said, Damn, Wally. I haven't been this excited in years.
Chapter 27. It had been difficult to convince the Kang family that they sincerely wanted to help, but after a few weeks of Big Mac dinners, a high level of trust developed. Each Wednesday, after an early dinner of something healthier, David and Helen pulled through the same McDonald's, ordered the same burgers and fries, and drove to the apartment complex in Rogers Park to visit the family. Zaw, the grandmother, and Lou, the grandfather, joined in because they were also fond of fast food. For the rest of the week, they lived on a diet that was primarily rice and chicken, but on Wednesday, the Kangs ate like real Americans. Helen, 7 months pregnant and looking every day of it, was initially hesitant about the weekly visits. If there was lead in the air, she had an unborn baby to protect. So David checked everything. He badgered Dr. Biff Sandroni until he cut his fee from $20,000 to $5,000, with David doing most of the legwork. David went through the apartment himself and collected samples of wall paint, water, ceramic coatings, cups and saucers, plates, mixing bowls, family photo albums, toys, shoes, clothing, virtually anything and everything the family came into contact with. He drove this collection to Sandroni's lab in Akron, dropped it off, then picked it up 2 weeks later and returned it to the family. According to Sandroni's report, there were only traces of lead, acceptable levels, and nothing for the family to worry about. Helen and the baby were safe in the Kang apartment. Tuya had been poisoned by the nasty teeth, and Dr. Sandroni was prepared to say so under oath in any court in the country. David was sitting on a promising lawsuit, but they had yet to find a defendant. He and Sandroni had a short list of 4 Chinese companies known to make similar toys for American importers, but they had not been able to pinpoint the manufacturer. And according to Sandroni, there was a good chance they would never identify it. The set of nasty teeth could have been made 20 years earlier than stored in a warehouse for a decade before being shipped to the U.S., where it could have spent another 5 years languishing in the supply chain. The manufacturer and the importer could still be in business, or they might have gone bust years ago. The Chinese were under constant pressure from U.S. watchdogs to monitor the amount of lead used in 1,000 products, and it was often impossible to determine who made what in the maze of cheap